Okay, so let me open day four of our conference, last one. Well, actually, no practical remarks almost this morning. You know, ICASP doesn't have any closing ceremony in the afternoon, and Grimsbotten, terrible name, well, but still better than AFIA Locul, the one last year, seems to calm down. So, well, I would like to thank you all for being here. Have a safe journey back and see you next year in Kyoto. And actually, the only thing that I learned only after having done these slides is that we have again a problem with the internet, so probably some effect of Grimsbotten again. Sorry for that, and we are working with this provider to fix it. So today we will have the last plenary given by Michael Jordan from Berkeley and Pierre Moulin from University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, will introduce our speaker.
Yes, thank you very much, Honka. So it's my great honor to introduce Professor Michael Jordan from University of California at Berkeley as our last plenary speaker for this conference. Many of you have known of his work. He's truly a living legend in the fields of artificial intelligence and machine learning, as recognized on some student forums, which I'll mention a little bit later briefly. His work has started, in fact, in control, as he just told me, when he was a PhD student at UC San Diego. Then he became a faculty member at MIT, where he developed his interest in machine learning and new fields. In general, if you have to characterize his work over the last 20 years, the word fundamental really takes its full meaning with him. He gets into a new field, analyzes it from scratch, does extremely deep work, and he has made absolutely incredible contributions over the last 20, 25 years. The topic he's going to talk about today is non-parametric analysis using Bayesian methods. In general, he's been interested, and he's quite famous for his work on graphical models, probabilistic graphical models, which have found applications in many areas. That's why he's a speaker here today. Many in statistical signal processing, some in other areas like natural language processing, computational biology, statistical genetics. He has been, of course, recognized tremendously for his work, both in statistics and engineering. For instance, last year he was elevated to National Academy member in the U.S., as well as to National Academy of Sciences member, and also is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So he's the first person, as far as I know, who got those three incredible distinctions the same year. He's also a fellow of the Institute for Mathematical Statistics, of the Association for Computing Machinery, of IEEE, of course, our own IEEE. In statistics, he's also a Nieman lecturer, as well as a Medallion lecturer. So these are very special distinctions. And before letting him take the podium, I'll just read off, I found when I was Googling his name and trying not to be confused with the basketball player, I found some words from students, student forums. Michael has a large number of students who have gone to extremely successful positions in academia and industry. And here's what I read on one of those forums. Michael Jordan is a living legend in artificial intelligence and machine learning. Your future in academia is fully secure if you can become his student, but he always seems already super busy with the legion of students he has so far. So he's going to keep us quite busy for the next hour, and I will let Michael take the podium now.
Thank you. So I'm delighted to be here, and I thank the organizers very much for inviting me. So the main goal of the talk is to tell you a little bit about what the title means, what is Bayesian nonparametrics. Just to anticipate a little bit, first of all, Bayesian just means you use probability pretty seriously. And this is already a community where probability has been used probably more than any other applied community I know of for a long, long time. So that's an easy part of my story. And non-parametrics doesn't mean there are no parameters. It means just the opposite. It means there's a growing number of parameters. So as you get more and more data, Bayesian non-parametrics allows you to have more and more parameters. It grows at something, a rate slower than the number of data points, but it grows. I think that's kind of a key modern perspective throughout statistics and signal processing. And the Bayesian has a particular take on that. So really there's a toolbox behind my talk, and what I'm going to try to do in the talk is give you an idea of what this toolbox is. You can use it to solve applied problems. It has a beautiful mathematical structure, and in some sense it's really just getting going, just getting started. So I'm going to try to convince you that you too can contribute here, both on a fundamental side and on a practical side. Let me acknowledge some collaborators near the bottom. Their names will appear throughout the talk, but let me point you to them in the beginning. So I have one slide on sort of a historical philosophy. I put computer science here, but this could equally be EE. All these fields in the 40s and 50s were somehow together. You know, people like Kolmogorov and Turing and so on kind of worked simultaneously in many of these fields. They separated because the problems got really hard, I believe. And computer science went off and started looking at data structures and algorithms, and didn't focus much on uncertainty. Statistics, on the other hand, focused on uncertainty and didn't focus too much on algorithms and data structures. And so Bayesian non-parametrics is one venue where these two things are coming together. And mathematically, really, it amounts to using stochastic processes. Instead of classical parametric distributions, you need a growing number of parameters, so you have distributions indexed by large spaces. Those are just called stochastic processes. So you're going to see that right in the beginning of this talk, some of the stochastic processes we're interested in looking at. And so to put this in a little bit of more of a statistical context, if you pick up a book on Bayesian analysis, you will see the posterior written as proportional to the likelihood times the prior, and usually write it out in a parametric way with the theta indexing the parameter space. And so this is a prior, this is a likelihood, and there's your posterior. In this talk, we don't want theta to be a finite dimensional object. We want it to be infinite dimensional, open-ended. So we're going to write, instead of theta, we're going to write g to reflect that. So p of x given g is still going to be a likelihood. And in this talk, this is mainly going to be a hidden Markov model, actually. So g will be the structure and all the parameters of a hidden Markov model, the state space and so on. And this is just the usual HMM. And this will be some kind of a structural component of HMMs. And we're going to put priors on that. So I'll be talking mostly about this and less about that. Anyway, the mathematical story is just that instead of having a classical prior distribution, you have a distribution on an infinite dimensional space. And that's not so strange mathematically. That is what a stochastic process is. So we have a prior stochastic process. It's going to be multiplied by some kind of a fairly classical likelihood, because once G is fixed, I don't care what the size of the space is, it's just a fixed object. And so the probability of data given G can be easily specified typically. So we multiply this prior by this likelihood, and we get ourselves a posterior stochastic process. So to give some more concrete idea of what these things are, we'll be talking a little bit about distributions on trees of unbounded depth and unbounded fanout. And you get these in genetics and natural language processing quite a bit. Stochastic processes on partitions arise a lot when you talk about clustering models where the number of clusters isn't known a priori. We can put distributions on grammars, on sparse matrices, on something called copulae. We can put distributions on distributions with this tool as well. So you can get kind of a recursivity that you see in computer science. I'm going to talk about one particular large class of stochastic processes called complete random measures, and we'll get into what those are. Those are one of the main ingredients of the toolbox I'm going to try to aim at talking about. Okay, so here's a familiar problem. I learned about this from some of my colleagues at ICSI. We've worked on this a bit. And I'm going to use it as a concrete way to show you that some of the methods I'm talking about can be rolled out in an applied domain. So I think everyone here knows what this problem is. There's a single microphone. There's a meeting going on. Here's the waveform. And ground truth is like this. So Bob spoke for a while, then John, then Jill, then Bob, and so on. We'd like to infer this from this. And we don't know how many people are in the room, and we don't know anything about the spectral characteristics of their speech. Here's the other problem I'm going to talk about, which is a little less traditional for you guys, I think. But it's a segmentation problem, and it's a multivariate segmentation, and it's a multi-time series segmentation problem. Okay, so someone came into a room, and this is motion capture, so they have sensors on their body, and I think it's about 60-dimensional So we have a 60-dimensional time series for this person. And as you can see, it's segmentable. They did a little bit of jumping jacks, a little bit of splits, a little bit of twists, so on and so forth. But we're not supposed to know that a priori. We don't know what the library of exercise routines was, and we don't know for this particular person which routines out of the big library they decided to use, how long they lasted, and where the breakpoints were and all that. So we'd like to infer all of that. Moreover, this is just one person's 60-dimensional time series. We're going to have this for many different people. So each person's going to come in, and we'll get a 60-dimensional time series for each one of them. And there'll be some overlap. Some people will do twists, some people will do touch your toes, and so on and so forth. Not everyone will do all routines, and there'll be some overlap. We would like to find that and then exploit it. So if I learn a little bit about what twists look like for one person, I'd like that to be available to be used to segment the time series for some other person. Okay, so it's a joint inference problem over multiple high-dimensional time series. Okay? Okay, so everyone in this audience knows what HMMs are. It's a pleasant audience to talk to for that reason. So here's three of the diagrams that are often used. I like the graphical model one here, where here's the states. So there's a Markov chain on multinomial random variables. You have emissions coming off of those, and here are the parameters sitting up there. The core of it, of course, is the transition matrix. This is a K by K matrix, and each row of it is a next state transition probability distribution. So given you're in state, say, 3 or 2, then you have a transition out of that. And I'm going to represent that as this little discrete measure here. It's just a bunch of atoms at locations which are the integers, and we have masses associated with them. And those are the transition probabilities going out from state 2, so this is pi 2, to all the next states, and there's k of these things. So it's a measure that has finite support, and we'll be talking about measures that have infinite support here pretty soon. So there would be pi 2. Pi 1 might be a different measure that maybe is sparse. It only has 2 non-zero atoms, and so on, pi 3 and so on. Okay, so those are the representations, the lattice, the graphical model, and explicit representations of the next state transitions that we'll be talking about in the talk. All right, so lots of issues with HMMs that are still, in some sense, unresolved. How many states should we use? So for the diarization problem, we don't know the number of speakers, so we have to infer that in some way. And the segmentation problem, we don't know the number of behaviors, twists and touch your toes and jumping jacks and all. There's some unknown number of behaviors. Now, I think even more interestingly, this latter problem has issues about the structure of the state space. So how do we encode the notion that a particular time series makes use of a particular subset of the state? That's a combinatorial notion. And I don't know how to encode that in a classical HMM, where there's just a set of states. How to share states among time series? I also don't know how to think about that. There's a structure, combinatorial structure in the state space that we don't have in a classical HMM. So that's going to go into my P of G. I'm going to put structural information in my prior, and then given the particular choice, I'm going to have that information available for inference at the HMM level. All right, so Bayesian non-parametrics solves these, I think, in a very elegant way and lots of other problems. So I'm going to try to show you what we do to do that. Okay, so I'm going to, again, be talking about random measures here, and let me kind of skip this slide. There's not really much being said here, and go right to an example of a random measure. All right, so everyone here knows what a measure is, right? It's just a set. You take a set in, and you get a number out, and the sets live in some sigma algebra. We want to talk about now random measures, okay? Because we're going to be probabilistic and do inference on measures. We're going to have random measures. So let's first of all start with something really easy. Let's put a random distribution on the integers. Okay, the integers go from 1 to infinity, and a distribution on them is just a countable set of numbers that sum to 1. We want a random distribution, so there's going to be a set of random numbers that sum to 1. All right, how do we do that? They have to kind of decay in some way so they can sum to 1, and there are many ways you can think of doing that. Here's a way that turns out to have beautiful combinatorial properties that allow us to develop inference algorithms based on this idea. So this is called stick breaking. It's an old idea in probability theory. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a number of beta random variables that we're going to take an infinite number of them and draw them independently. So beta sub k is a beta random variable. It has 2 parameters normally, but we're going to pin the first one to 1 and the other one will be free. Beta random variables live between 0 and 1, right? And if you take alpha naught to be bigger and bigger and bigger, this thing tilts and up to the left. So most of the mass is near the origin and less of the mass is near 1. Okay, so think of getting lots of small numbers out of these beta random variables. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a stick that goes from 0 to 1, and we're going to break off the first fraction of it according to beta 1. And I'm going to call that pi 1. And then the remainder of the stick is 1 minus beta 1, and I'm going to take a fraction of that, beta 2, and this little part right here is that amount, beta 2 times the rest. And I'm going to call that pi 2. Here's pi 3, pi 4, pi 5, and so on. So we just keep breaking off pieces of the stick, and the total stick has mass 1. And so as we do this out to infinity, we're going to get the pi's will eventually sum to 1. So that's actually easy to prove. If you want to prove it here, you get that these pi's will sum to 1 according to this procedure. All right, so now that's a way to get, we now have these pi's, they are a distribution for any fixed pi's, and they're random. So we have random distributions on the integers. So having learned how to do that, we now can promote these up to distributions on arbitrary spaces using that tool. So here's how that's done. You use these same pi's as before as weights in a little mixture model. It's an infinite mixture, and the mixture components are these delta functions. So these are Dirac deltas. They're unit masses at locations phi k. And the phi k are independent draws from a distribution g-naught on some space. So this some space can be some arbitrary space. It doesn't have to be Euclidean space. It can be a function space. It can be a Banach space. It can be just about anything. And so these atoms just are living on that space, and they're being weighted by these mixing proportionals, pi k. All right. So each one of these has unit mass, and they're being weighted by these things, which sum to 1. So this total object g is a spiky object. It's a measure. Its total mass is 1, and it lives on some space. And it's random in two ways. It's random because the pi's are gotten by stick breaking, and because these phi k's were drawn from some distribution, g-naught, which is the source of these things. I'll be calling these things atoms, so g-naught is the source of the atoms. So we have these weighted atoms on some space. All right, so that is a random measure. If I take g of some set A, it'll give me a number, so it's a measure. It's additive and so on. And it's random in two ways, so it's a random measure. So this is a very general way now of getting atoms. If I do the pi's according to stick breaking, this particular object G has a name. It's called the Dirichlet process, and I usually write it like this. It has these two parameters, the stick breaking parameter and the source of the atoms parameter. But we can break sticks in different ways and get the atoms in different ways, so this is actually a widely useful tool. All right, so we can now use this as a component of various kinds of statistical models. Here's something called the Dirichlet process mixture model, and it's kind of just what you would think it was. We're going to use G, a draw from G, which I've now drawn in this way. It's on some space, but the space here is the real line, just so I can draw it. It has atoms at locations given by drawing from some underlying distribution G-naught, and it has heights of these atoms given by stick breaking with this parameter alpha-naught. So if I draw a specific G, I get an object looking like that. Right, now, to use this in the context of a mixture model, I just use this as a distribution. Okay, it's not your typical Gaussian. It's a distribution. It's random. And I draw from it. So I might draw this atom in the middle there because it has high probability. It has a big height. And having drawn that, that's a parameter now for some underlying likelihood. And I wrote it down here. The x given theta is coming from some distribution indexed by theta. So I do that again and again, and that's this plate here, that box. And that gives me a mixture model. In fact, there's some probability that I'll get the same atom on successive draws of theta, and so those indices I would be coming from the same atom. We would think of those as belonging to the same cluster. All right, so that's a Dirichlet process mixture model. Here's some kind of artificial data drawn from one of these things. Here I'm drawing more and more data as I go across here. You start seeing the blue dots, more and more data. And the parameters, theta, in this case, are means and covariances of Gaussians. Theta is a whole big long vector. And you see that the number of distinct ones was growing. There's only a few distinct ones, and then you get more and more, and they grow at some rate. In fact, that rate turns out to be logarithm of n, logarithm of the number of data points. So the number of parameters we have in this system is growing. We had a small number of parameters here. And we keep drawing from G again and again and again. We get more and more parameters. And like I said, it grows at rate log n. So we're non-parametric here. We don't have a fixed parameter space no matter how much data we have. As you show me more and more data, I'm going to give you more and more parameters. Okay, so let's go back to this little slide here. And as I've been alluding to, with some probability, if I picked theta 1 equal to this atom here in the middle, with some probability theta 2 is equal to that exact same atom. And so those two data points would come from the same cluster. You can ask, what's the kind of combinatorial structure induced by this kind of procedure? How often does that happen? So what's the probability that theta 2 is equal to theta 1, no matter where theta 1 occurred? The probability that you get a lightning hitting twice in the same place. And what is that probability, in fact, not over for this particular G, but for over all possible choices of G under this procedure that I outlined, this P of G? So you'd think that would be a really hard problem to solve. That sounds complicated. And it turns out that it's really easy to solve. It turns out the answer is a half. And so to understand that, you need to understand something called the Chinese restaurant process. This is another stochastic process. This is on partitions, not on parameters. This is on partitions. And this here, I have a little drawing of this down here. You have customers coming to a restaurant with an infinite number of tables. So here are these round tables. It's a Chinese restaurant. That's why they're round. And the first customer sits here with probability 1. The second customer joins them with probability half and starts a new table with probability half. And the general rule is you sit at a table proportional to the number of people already at the table. So that's often called preferential attachment. You'll start to get a big cluster emerging and some smaller clusters after that. And you can easily prove from this little setup here that the number of occupied tables grows at rate log n. Okay, so it's a beautiful mathematical fact that if you do the integrals I was talking about for the Dirichlet process, this turns out to be the marginal probability under the Dirichlet process of who sits with who. Okay, so it's another perspective. It's a marginal under that other big probability measure, P of G. And you can make this into an explicit clustering model, a mixture model effectively, but now thought of it in terms of clustering instead of mixture components. And all you do is that the first person to sit at a table draws a parameter for that table from some prior, which we could call G naught. It's the same G naught as before, actually. And everybody who sits at the table inherits that same parameter vector. So if phi 1 here is a mean and a covariance of a Gaussian, then all the data points or customers around this table would all come from the same Gaussian, have the same mean and covariance matrix. Okay, so this is actually exactly a marginal of the Dirichlet process mixture model. Okay, so that's kind of a little bit of tutorial. This has been 40 years old, the Dirichlet process mixture models. It's been slowly evolving and slowly getting taken up in applied communities, but it's been very, very slow. Now, to use this in a richer class of problems than just mixture models and clustering, you often have to face the problem that you have multiple estimation problems. You have one, not just one set of data, you have multiple sets of data. And in the HMM case, that's going to come because we have the current state, which indexes the next state. So we have a bunch of distributions, the next state distributions for all of the current states. So we don't just have one distribution, we have a whole bunch of distributions. Or they're all the rows of the transition matrix. We need to estimate all those rows. So in statistics, we often have this arising that we have multiple estimation problems. There's some parameter, and then there's some data based on that. There's another parameter's data based on that. And we often want to tie these things together because there might be very little data over here and a lot of data over here. And if these are related problems, it makes sense to tie these together. And that's called hierarchical modeling. It's one of the main reasons to be a Bayesian, which is very easy to make these kind of hierarchical models and tie things together. And so what you do is you assume that the parameter for all these subproblems, these parameters are related by coming from an underlying parameter. So you draw these randomly from an underlying theta, and now all the data over here kind of goes up through this tree and down to here, and the posterior estimate of theta I depends on all the data here, and it's a convex combination of all the data. So that arises out of the hierarchical Bayesian perspective, and here's kind of a picture of that. Here's the one I just showed, and here's a kind of the graphical model representation of that using these boxes to represent replications. So that outermost box represents these M replications down below. Okay, so we can do that now with the Dirichlet process. And so this is a paper that we published a few years ago, Hierarchical Dirichlet Processes. This is, I think, really a very useful tool. It's just the hierarchy applied to Dirichlet process mixtures. So we have the same kind of setup as before, but now we don't just have one G. We have G1, G2, G3, G4 for the different estimation problems, the different groups. And if you want to be concrete about this, this is the different rows of the HMM. Each one of them it's a measure, and we have a set of measures, all the different rows. And we want to tie them together so they have the same next state space that they all transition to. So what we're going to do is not going to draw these things independently, and we're not going to lump them all together. We want different transition probabilities, and we don't want them to be completely separate state spaces. They've got to be tied together in some way. So the way you do this is that you have an extra layer of this graph. You first of all draw from some source of atoms a mother distribution, G naught. It's now random instead of being fixed parameter like before. And now that's the base measure that you used to go into each of the children. And they redraw the atoms from G naught, and they reweight them according to their own stick breaking process. Okay? So this ties together a set of random measures and makes them cooperate on what are the atoms they're all going to use and what are the weights that they're going to use. This also has a restaurant underneath it, which is a really easy way to understand these ideas. We now don't have just one restaurant. We have multiple restaurants, M restaurants in general. And again, this would, in my application to HMMs, these will be the different current states or different rows of a transition matrix. All right, so if you're in restaurant number two, you go in and you sit at a table proportional to the number of people already at the table, just like before. That'll get sharing or clustering within a restaurant. Then, if I'm the first person to sit at a table, I go up to a global menu of dishes for the entire franchise, and I pick a dish from this menu. Maybe I pick Kung Pao chicken up here. And if I pick Kung Pao chicken, I bring it down to my table, and everybody who joins me at my table has to eat that same dish. We all have the same parameter. But I also put a check mark next to that dish, and if you are in some other restaurant, and you're the first person to sit at your table, you go up to this menu, and you pick a dish proportional to the number of check marks next to the dish. Okay, so you get some dishes up here that are popular across all of the restaurants, not just within one restaurant, and they get transferred between the restaurants according to this kind of preferential attachment mechanism. Okay, so again, in the HMM setting, these will be the rows of the transition matrix. The number of possible transitions is growing as you get more and more data. So I don't just have K states, I have a growing number of states. And the states are being shared among all the different rows of the transition matrix according to this restaurant. Now I have a really nice application of this that we published earlier this year that I'm gonna, I think, skip in the interest of time in this talk, but we have a paper on this. I think it's kind of the killer app for this problem. You're basically trying to model some of the geometry of proteins. Here's kind of some of the angles that you get in proteins. And if you put all the data for a particular amino acid on top of each other, you get kind of these fuzzy diagrams where they're not very precise. And so what you really want to do is not just have one estimation problem of the density of angles. You want to break them up according to the context, like n-grams. You want to not just have one distribution, you want to have a bunch of them depending on the context. When you break them up according to context, however, you have a sparse data problem. Many of the contexts have very little data in them. So it's a very familiar kind of problem in lots of settings, including signal processing and speech. And so we want to have models like this that are depending on the context of the neighboring amino acids. So this setup is exactly that. The groups are the neighborhoods. So for each context, you have a group of data, and you don't treat them separately, you don't lump them together, rather you have them cooperate by this tree. And every one of the Dirichlet processes, this looks kind of like a Dirichlet process, like that synthetic data I showed you earlier, but you really have 20 amino acids on the left, 20 on the right, we get 400 estimation problems, 400 contexts, as we have 400 diagrams like this, and we get them to share atoms according to this procedure. So I'm going to skip over some of the results, but they're impressive. This is kind of log probability improvement on test set for all the twin amino acids. Here's no improvement, and this is over what they had been currently doing in the protein folding literature. So it's really quite massive improvement. Okay, so let's go back to hidden Markov models, where our likelihood is a hidden Markov model, and our prior now is this structural machinery I've been telling you about. Okay, so now we have a hidden Markov model where we don't have a fixed number of states. We call this a HDP HMM. We have an infinite number of states, so here's time and here's the state space. And so when you enter one of these current states, you have a distribution on next states, and you can think of that like a Chinese restaurant process. Here's table one, table two, table three, table four, and there's a growing number of tables. All right, now if I do that for every time I hit state number two, then that's great. I can get a growing number of tables, but I want to share those tables between state number two and three and four and so on. So as I've been talking about, I need this hierarchical Dirichlet process to tie together all those transitions. Okay, so I'm going to kind of go quickly through the slides. Again, details aren't what I'm trying to convey here. It's just kind of a bit of the spirit. So briefly, what you do is you draw a mother transition distribution for all states. And then everybody for each current state is a perturbation off of that. So here's pi 3. It takes this and kind of reweights all these atoms, and pi 4, and so on and so forth. Okay? All right. So I hope that was kind of clear. This is a way of doing HMMs where you don't know the number of states a priori, and actually you're putting a prior distribution on the number of states. And it can grow as you get more and more data. So kind of a nice solution to a classical problem in HMM land. So we implemented this. There is a simple sampling procedure. We did a slightly non-simple procedure, but there's a whole bunch of procedures that can be used to do posterior inference with this, i.e. given some emission, some data, infer the most probable HMM, infer the trajectory, the Viterbi path, infer everything else you want to infer, all the parameters about this. You can do this pretty easily on a computer, just kind of a tweak on standard HMM methodology. All right, so when we did this, we applied it to the diarization data, and we did okay, but not particularly well, and we identified one problem we needed to solve before we could start to get performance that which was satisfactory, And that was that we had a little bit too much state splitting going on. So here's a little synthetic problem in which here's time. There were three states in our synthetic data, as you can see here. So, this state was on for a few time frames, and then this state, and so on. Here was the data, and you can sort of see that there are three states here, but, it's pretty noisy. It'd be kind of hard to tell that just by looking. Here's the output of our inference system, our computer program that infers the HDP-HMM. And it did find three states here, but then it actually found a fourth state. And the problem was that the parameters for state 3 and state 4, the emission distributions, happened to be just about the same. Could happen, and it happened here. And so when you were in state 3 and 4, from the outside world point of view, the emission probabilities were basically the same. So the system was doing perfectly well, had high likelihood, and it was then flickering between state 3 and 4. And again, it had high likelihood, so why not? There's nothing that prevents it from doing that. But we don't want that, of course, because now we didn't do very good in the diarization problem. We thought there were four people in the room, and there were only three. Okay, so we're being Bayesian in this problem, and so we don't mind putting a little bit more prior knowledge into this. We put basically none in at this point. So let's put a little bit more in, which is that people don't tend to talk for microsecond or millisecond time intervals. They tend to talk for seconds. So we have one extra parameter, a self-transition probability in the HMM. The diagonal of this infinite matrix is going to be treated a little bit special. Get an extra boost. All right? So we have one extra parameter, which is the extra boost for self-transition. Something like a semi-Markov in HMM. Okay? So we call that a sticky HDP-HMM. It just has the transition distributions before plus one parameter which boosts the self-transitions. So if there's the distributions you had before, then we add a little bit to that to give ourselves a little bit of boost for the self-transitions. Okay, that parameter we're being Bayesian is, again, a parameter to be inferred by the given the data. It's random, and it has a posterior distribution. Okay, so we put that into our system, and we're now ready to report some results. Okay, so we went back to the speaker diarization problem and implemented this on data. I think this was 2007, the NIST RT competition data. We didn't compete in this. We simply took the data and compared to what had been done by people who did compete. So this is diarization error rate, and ICSI results have been the state of the art for this at that time, and I don't remember if they are still, but they were the state of result, by a wide margin at the time. And this is over the 21 meetings, and these are comparisons to the ICSI, just to get a flavor. So our sticky results are basically comparative to the red ones, which are the ICSI. So if you just kind of scan through here, the green ones are the non-sticky HDP-HMM, and you can see they're worse, and that was assigned to us when we actually originally implemented this that something was not quite working. So if you do a head-to-head, basically we were comparative with the ICSI results at this time. I do want to say that my goal in showing these numbers is not to say that we are beating anybody or that we're competitive. This was 2007. We're not speech people. We didn't try to compete. But the results are, in fact, competitive with a state-of-the-art system. And the main point I want to make is that this was done by Emily Fox, a grad student who visited my group during the summer, and she learned about the HDP-HMM, and she implemented this and did all that in one summer project. All right, so this is not that hard to do. It's a tool, just like the HMM. You can learn, and you can use it, and you can get, competitive results doing this. We have not pursued this, and I know that the ICSI team actually did a discriminative method after that that got some better numbers. But all these numbers are getting pretty good, and I think that this particular approach, if pursued, can be one of the best methods out there. I recall when HMMs first came about, I was actually a grad student at the time, and the very first paper on HMMs gave some numerical results compared to dynamic time warping, and they were okay, but not greatly better. But of course, that was enough, and that set the whole field off to heading in that direction. And I would like to think that this is going to be the case also for these Bayesian parametric methods. They're easy to implement. They're just a small twist on what you're used to. They're just HMMs, a little bit of extra that you can move to a new table in the restaurant, a little bit of indexing of multiple restaurants. They're really easy to implement, and they're robust. One student can just implement it, and it works. It works well. So I do think they're going to play a role. See, these are some examples of actual meetings. These are where the diarization rates for both us and ICSI are quite small. So you can see here we basically have solved the problem. And here's a meeting where things were a little bit worse. There was one meeting which we did particularly badly. And it turned out that wasn't the model as bad. It's turned out that the mixing, we were using an MCMC algorithm for this. The mixing was quite slow on that meeting. We hadn't mixed by the time we stopped. And so that's still an ongoing issue of how to make sure the Markov chains mix if we're going to use Markov chains for this methodology. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about derivation. Let me just briefly mention a couple of other applications of the HDP. They've been used in many other kinds of problems, not just for HMMs. In fact, you can use these for PCFGs, for probabilistic context-free grammars. And so in this case, you have a parse tree, and the number of rules are like clusters if you're doing statistical NLP, and you grow the number of clusters as you see more and more data. And the same rule can appear multiple places in the parse tree. That's why you have multiple restaurants in the Chinese restaurant for exactly the same reasons. You want to share statistical strength in different locations in parse trees. So we have built a system that does that and are able to then infer most probable rule sets from data in parsing and build parsers based on this. So I'm going to skip that. Okay, so that was the Dirichlet process. And I'm going to stop talking about the Dirichlet process. There's lots more to say. Lots of people have been working on it, but I'm going to stop because I want to move on and tell you about some of the other stochastic processes that are in the toolbox. So one that I'm particularly interested in these days is called the beta process. So where the Dirichlet process, when you enter the restaurant, you have to sit at one table. The beta process allows you to enter the restaurant and sit at multiple tables. Okay? So you should think about the tables now as not like clusters, but as like a featural, a bit vector description of entities. So if you sit at table 1, 3, and 17, and I sit at 3, 17, and 35, we have a little bit of overlap among each other. So bit vectors can overlap in interesting ways. And so that's what the beta process allows us to do that the Dirichlet process does not. Okay, now beyond the beta process, I'll tell you a little bit more about the beta process here in a minute, but I want to tell you briefly about the general framework. So Kingman had a very important paper in 1967 and 1968 called On Completely Random Measures. The beta process is an example of a completely random measure. And completely random measures are really simple to talk about and to work with. All they are measures, they're random measures on a set, just like before. But what's new here is that they assign independent mass to non-intersecting subsets of the space. So I have a picture of this in the next, yeah, here we go. So here's some arbitrary space. Here's a set A and here's a set B. And here this red object is a random measure, a discrete measure on this space. And so there's a random amount of mass that fell into set A and a random amount that fell into B. And if that random variable here and here, the random mass, is independent because these are non-overlapping sets, then this random measure is called completely random. So it's a really nice concept. It leads to divide and conquer algorithms. It's basically, has computational consequences. Okay, so there are lots and lots of things. You know what Brownian motion is. Well, Brownian motion, it turns out, is a special case of this. Gamma processes, beta processes, and all kinds of other interesting objects. Dirichlet process is not completely a random process, but it's a normalized gamma process. Okay, so now, Kingman had a very beautiful result characterizing completely random processes. And it turns out that they can be derived from Poisson point processes. So the Poisson process lies behind all of this, and it's a really beautiful construction, which I'm going to tell you about here really briefly. What we're trying to do, remember, is we have the space omega, and we're trying to put random measures on it. I told you how to put Dirichlet process measures on spaces. I'm going to now be more general and tell you to put all kinds of other random measures on spaces. The way you do it is you take the original space omega and you cross it with a real line. So you look at the product space, omega cross R. Okay? I'm going to put a Poisson process in that product space. How do you put a Poisson process on things? Well, you have to tell me what the rate function is. You're probably familiar with the homogeneous Poisson process where you just have a flat rate, a constant rate function. And then in any little interval, or actually in this case any little set, the number of points falling there is a Poisson random variable with some rate number. But I can let the rate vary, and so now the Poisson the Poisson rate is an integral of a rate function over that little set. So you have to write down the rate function. Here it is, and so I've integrated over that rate function to get now Poisson rates for every little small set of this space, and here's a draw from that Poisson point process. So you see this thing was tilting up into the left. I got more points down here and fewer up here. Now, having drawn from this Poisson process with this rate function, then I forget all this machinery, and I just look at this red thing here. I take each x and I drop a line from that x down to the omega axis. And now that resulting object is a measure on the omega space. It's a discrete measure, and it's random, and it's a completely random measure because any mass that falls into some set A here and some set B here will be independent because it's an underlying Poisson process. The beautiful fact is that all completely random measures can be gotten this way. Okay, so one direction is trivial, the other direction is quite non-trivial. So if you like completely random measures, and I do, then this theorem says you can reduce the study of these measures to the study of the Poisson process, and it's just the rate functions of Poisson process. So I think that's a toolbox. I think that in this field and the others, that we will be studying rate measures for Poisson processes as ways to specify combinatorial structures on things. Okay, so the particular example of the beta process has this thing as its rate function. Remember, rate functions had two arguments. There was the omega part and the real line part. The omega part is just some atom, some measure that gives you, the prior on atoms, just like it was G-naught before, now it's called B-naught. And then here for the beta process is the beta density, and it's an improper beta density, which gives you an infinite collection of points when you draw from the point process, which is what we want. We don't want a finite number. That would be a parametric prior. We want a non-parametric prior, so we need this thing to be improper, degenerate. Okay, so that's probably too much math. Let me just draw a picture. So here is that rate function. It has a singularity at the origin, so it really tilts up sharply at the origin. It breaks off. It stops at 1. And so all the points, when you do the Poisson point process, you get lots and lots of points that are very near the origin. And if you now take this sum by dropping from down from the y-coordinate down to the x-coordinate, then it looks like this. All right, so pi is the height of an atom, and omega I is the location of the atom. And you take that infinite sum, and that object now is a random measure. So this is another way of getting random measures. I told you about stick breaking before. This is another way of getting random measures, which is much more general. And in particular, these PIs do not sum to 1. They're between 0 and 1, but they do not sum to 1. And they're independent. All right. So I like to think of these as coin tossing probabilities, and I like to think of this as now an infinite collection of coins. And most of the coins have probability nearly zero. So if I toss all these coins, I'll get a few ones and lots of zeros. In fact, I'll get an infinite set of zeros and a few ones. And if I do that again, I'll again get a few ones and a lot of zeros. And if I keep doing that, there'll be a few places where I'm going to get lots of ones. There'll be a lot of overlap and lots of other places where there's less overlap. So I have a picture showing that. Here I've drawn from the beta process. That's that blue thing right there. It lives between 0 and 1. It's mostly nearly zero. And then here's 100 draws with these. Think of these as coins, and think of these heights as the probability of one of heads. So if I draw, this one has a kind of a big head probability here, so I get lots of ones, or relatively lots of ones, as I go down the column. And in some region over here, then I have nearly all zeros of my coin tossing probabilities. I get almost all zeros. Okay, so think of a row of this matrix now. This is a sparse, binary, infinite dimensional, random matrix. I think of this as a feature vector for a bunch of entities. So here's 100 entities, and if you think of this as like in a Chinese restaurant, entity number 100 came into the restaurant and didn't just sit at one table. It sat at this table, this table, and this table, this table, and this table, maybe four different tables. The next person comes in, number 99, and didn't sit at the first table, but sat at the fourth table, and blah, 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 blah. All right, so this captures the sitting pattern of 100 people who've come into this restaurant and all the tables they sat at. And the total number of tables, as you keep doing this, is going to grow. It's going to get denser and denser and fill out. But it grows again at a slow rate. Okay, so there's different parameters of this process, and you can get different kinds of matrices depending on the setting of these parameters. All right, so that's probably way too abstract for you to appreciate why you'd want to do that. Let me just say that there also is a restaurant metaphor here. There's something called the Indian buffet process, which captures the sitting pattern directly on the matrix, not talking about the underlying beta process, just like the Chinese restaurant captures the sitting pattern for the Dirichlet process and not talking about the underlying Dirichlet process. Literally, it's a marginal probability under the beta process. So I'm going to skip that. I want to move to all the way. Here we go, back to this problem where I can make it concrete again. Okay, so remember this problem of the multiple time series. I had these people coming into the room and doing these exercise routines, and I don't know how many routines there are in the library, and I don't know who does what routine. And each person doesn't do just one routine, they do a subset of routines. Okay? All right, so how am I going to model this? All right, well, it's time series and it has segments in it. I'm probably going to use an HMM as my basic likelihood. But now I've got to put some structure around that to capture all this combinatorial structure about my problem. All right. So the way that I'm going to do that is I'm using the beta process. And I have a slide on this. I think I'm just going to try to say this in English while you stare at the slide and the math, if you care to. But I encourage you not just to listen to me tell you how this works. Okay, so let's suppose that everybody in this room is going to come up here on the stage and do the little exercise routine. So every one of you is going to do your own little subset. There's an infinite library up there of possible routines you could do. You choose, before you come up on stage, which subset of that library you're going to actually pick out and you're going to do. Maybe I'm going to do jumping jacks and twists, and that's all I'm going to do. All right? Now, up in heaven, there is an infinite by infinite transition matrix that God possesses, that none of us get to possess. And I pick out twists and jumping jacks from that infinite matrix. So I'm going to pick out a little 2x2 sub-matrix. Maybe twist is column number 37 and jumping jacks is number 42. So I pick out those columns and the corresponding rows. So I get a little 2x2 matrix, and I bring it down out of the infinite matrix, and I instantiate that in a classical HMM. Okay, it's actually an autoregressive HMM, so I can get a little bit of oscillation because these are oscillatory movements. All right, and now I run a classical HMM for me doing my exercise routine. My emissions are the 60-dimensional vector of positions, and it's just an HMM. All right, now I run the forward-backward algorithm, and I get some update to the parameters. And I don't update my little local HMM. I go back up to the infinite matrix, and in that little 2x2, that's where I put the updates from the Baum-Welch algorithm. All right, now he comes in. He's the next person to come on the stage, and he picked also column 35, but he did 101 and 117 maybe. So he picks out a 3x3 subset of the matrix. He runs his HMM on his data, gets a Baum-Welch update, and then goes back to the infinite matrix and changes that 3x3 submatrix as well. And as we all keep doing that, we're going to be changing overlapping subsets of that infinite matrix. Okay? So that's the beta process AR-HMM. Okay? So I hope that you kind of got the spirit of that. It is just an HMM, and there are one HMM for each of the people doing the exercise routine. And then the beta process is this machinery up here, which gives us a feature vector of which of the subsets of states out of the infinite sets of states that I actually use. All right. So again, this maybe look a little bit complicated. It's not. It's actually very easy to put on the computer. And again, it was Emily again. Emily came and implemented this in her second summer with us and built the software to do this. Okay, so anyway, it's just a HMM likelihood with a beta process prior on the way the parameters are structured. All right, now this actually really worked. So here are motion capture results. This is non-trivial problem. Lots of methods don't do well at all on this problem. It's a bit qualitative to see how well we're doing, but I think you'll kind of agree if you look at the results, we're doing extremely well. So here is the first feature. If you picked that state, i.e. feature, then, and you just held that fixed in the HMM, it's an autoregressive HMM, so it'll oscillate. And the oscillation is the arms go up and down. So this has kind of picked out this jumping jacks routine. This one, if you take that feature and you put it in the HMM and you don't let any transitions happen, you get the knees wobbling back and forth. Here you get some kind of twisting motion of the hips. Here's some more wobbling something or other. Here's where the arms are going in circles. And so on. Near the bottom, you start to get a little bit more subdivision of the states than maybe we might like, although Emily thinks that there's kind of good kinematic reasons that these are actually to be different. But this did nail the problem. It took in this 60-dimensional time series, multiple ones, knew nothing about the number of segments and where the segments occurred, and jointly segmented them among all the different users of this exercise program. All right. How am I doing on time? Okay, so I'm about to run out of time. I'm just going to, I think, again, skip some slides here and just say something about this model. So this is something I've worked on for a number of years. It's an exchangeable model, i.e. bag of words model for text called late original allocations. It's fairly widely known. It's extremely simple. It's too simple for really lots of real-world phenomena. And so we've been working on making it more interesting. And so what the LDA model does is it takes a bag of words representation of a text and it re-represents text in terms of what are called topics. A topic is a probability distribution on words. And so a given document can express a subset of topics, maybe sports and travel. And so all the words in the document come from the sports topic or the travel topic, and you get mixtures, or what are called admixtures, of topics within a single document. The problem with this approach, with many problems, one of them is that the words like function words tend to occur in every single topic. Because if I have a document only about travel and the function words don't occur in that topic, then I can't get the function words in that document and I'll get a very low probability document. All right? So we'd like to separate out things like function words and other kinds of abstract words from more concrete words and make an abstraction hierarchy. All right, so we have done that. There's a paper that was in JACM this year, and I encourage you to look at this. I'm more proud of this in some sense than LDA as a kind of a path forward for this field. We call this the nested Chinese restaurant process. And so this is a whole Chinese restaurant up here, and here's another Chinese restaurant. All these are Chinese restaurants. They're now organized in a tree. When you go into a Chinese restaurant, you pick a table like before, and that tells you what branch to leave to go to the next restaurant. So if you think about this as the first night here in Prague, you pick some restaurant, and then you learn what branch you learn what restaurant you need to go to on the second night, and then the third night, and so on, as you keep going through the nights of the conference. All right, so a document comes down here and picks a path down this tree. Another document comes in and picks another path, and they will typically overlap. And so you will get these overlapping branching structures. All right, and now you put a topic at every node of this tree. It has a distribution on words, and then a document has a path down the tree that gives it a set of topics it can draw from, and then it draws the words from that set of topics. All right? Now, that node up at the top is being used by all documents, so it makes a lot of sense to put the function words up there. All right? Whereas this node down here is only being used by a small subset of the documents, so you might as well put some more concrete words down there. And that's what the statistics does. When you fit this to data, it develops topics at the top of the tree, which are more abstract, and more concrete topics as you go down the tree. All right, so I'm going to just skip, and here's my last slide, actually. This is the results, if you'll turn your head, of fitting this to I think this is actually not Psychology Today. I should change this. It's an error. Psych Review. These are abstracts from a particular journal in psychology. And this is the most probable tree. We're putting a distribution on the tree. Everything is a distribution here. And this is the most high probability tree, and this is the most high probability topic, or high probability words at the topic at that node. So we get the and of as the high probability words at the root. So we didn't have to strip away the function words in this case. They just bubbled up to the root. The next level, we get model memory, self-social psychology, motion, vision, binocular, drug, food, brain. So this looks kind of like social psychology, cognitive psychology, physiological psychology, and visual psychology. And so on as you go down the tree. And this is actually an infinite tree. We just are showing the first three levels of the tree. So anyway, I hope that gives you a little more flavor of, you know, the toolbox notion here. We put Chinese restaurants together with a object with distributions on trees, and we can suddenly do things like abstraction and reason about that. So I am done. I was just kind of a tour of a few highlights of a literature. There are probably about 100 people worldwide are working in this topic. Actively, there's a conference called Bayesian Nonparametrics. It's being held in Veracruz later this month. Every 2 years, it's being held, and it has just been getting going. So, especially for the younger people in the audience, I highly encourage you to look at this. There's a little bit of work being brought into speech and signal processing, but there's going to be a whole lot more. So, on my publication page, there are two papers which I might point you to if you enjoyed the talk, that are written for a non-expert and give you lots of pointers to more technical literature. Thank you very much. I guess there's time for questions.
Yes, thank you, Professor Jordan, for a truly inspiring talk. And we still have time for some questions from the audience.
Hearing our Chinese restaurant and Indian buffet makes us hungry already early in the morning.
Good.
So I have two questions. First of all, thank you very much for introducing these powerful tools to our community. The first question that I have is the way we understand for large scale the problem, since this set of techniques require Monte Carlo simulation, it appears to me that it's going to make the scalability of real difficult issue.
No, I don't believe that at all. So no one knows, really, when we go to large scale. So, you know, the EM algorithm, does that apply to large scale problems or not? Yeah, yes and no. I mean, for some problems, things really quickly settle down after a very quick number of iterations of EM. Maybe like two iterations of EM are enough for some problems. These algorithms that I showed you today are just Gibbs samplers. And so it's the EM algorithm plus one extra step. It's just literally EM. Do like EM before, you know, change the indicator from this to this, or go to a brand new table. All right. So we actually don't know whether posterior inference algorithms on large scale are going to mix. They may mix more quickly than we're used to from small data sets. Okay. And the last point to make is that this has nothing to do with MCMC. That's just what we happened to use because this was, we had 3 months to do the project. Any other procedure, there's split and merge algorithms, there's variational methods and so on for posterior inference can be used here.
That's great so news.
Yeah.
Now the second question that I have is that many people in this audience very often believe that the hidden Markov that you used throughout your talk as an example are not a realistic model, a good model, for at least for speech and in many other physical processes that we have interest in.
Yeah.
We are interested. The reason why people use that is just because, number one, inference is easy, and then learning is easy.
Correct.
So I just want to know your take on to what extent this set of techniques can generalize beyond the hidden Markov model.
Okay, that's a great question. Thank you very much. Yeah, so those two papers are aiming at answering your question, trying to show the toolbox notion. There's a range of other kinds of models we can consider here. The Dirichlet process, for example, doesn't have power law behavior. You might want power law behavior. There's something else called the Pittman-Yor, which gives you power law behavior. You can do a Pittman-Yor version of the HDP-HMM. So there are many, many generalizations. There's inverse gamma forms of the weights, and so on and so forth. This really is a toolbox. And I think also the point about, I'm a statistician. We're used to cartoon models, which if you find the right cartoon, it can really work surprisingly well. And so the HMM, yes, it's not the right model for speech, but that's what they said in 1980, right? And it still was the elephant that got speech all the way to where it is, maybe badly, maybe wrongly, right? It is a very useful to make cartoons that do have nice statistical and computational properties and can be generalized. So I think the HMM was too much of a box. It couldn't be generalized easily, and I think that these methods go beyond that quite significantly, but still staying within a probabilistic framework. Put a slide back up. Oh, he'd have to do that in the back. I don't have control over that. Was there another question? I can summarize what you say. Yeah. Yeah, so his question is about overfitting. Why aren't you getting killed on overfitting in a non-parametric world? Well, it's easy for me to say this, but Bayesians don't have such problems with overfitting. It's kind of, I'm not always a Bayesian, but when I am a Bayesian, it's one of the main reasons I am. To first order, we don't have overfitting troubles with these systems, even on pretty large scale problems. That's just a fact. When we compare this, for example, in our context-free grammar stuff, the competitor there was a split-merge EM algorithm. And there they had a big overfitting problem. They kind of dealt with that, eventually a pretty effective way. But we didn't have to think about that. It just didn't, it didn't come up. So that's to first order. To second order, you have a couple of hyperparameters. You have to get them in the right range. If you don't get them in the right range, you'll have some overfitting. But we're very robust to that. And so you're right, at the end of the day, it didn't totally work just out of the box. We had a little overfitting. There was one more state than there should have been. But that's not too bad. Then it was not too easy to do a little bit of engineering and think about the problem a little bit more and say, a little bit of time scale prior needs to be put in here. So I think that's fine. We're sort of artists and engineers. We're trying to, we don't just want to build a box that, you give to a high school student and it's done. There'll always be a little bit of thinking and a little bit of engineering and a toolbox notion. I'm not always a Bayesian. There's lots of reasons to be a non-Bayesian. I go back and forth every single day of my life. But for a lot of these really high dimensional, hard inference problems where you have multiple things which need to kind of collaborate via the hierarchy, Bayes just gives you from the get-go, a lot of control over those sorts of things.
Any other question?
So for speech, we use mixture models within each state. Is there a way to decide when to create a new state versus when to add a new component?
Yeah, excellent question. I should have made that clear. So the state-specific emission distribution here is not a single Gaussian, for reasons that you guys know extremely well. Is it a mixture of Gaussians? No. It's a Dirichlet process mixture of Gaussians. All right. And it turned out that was critical for us to get this to work. Absolutely. We need, just like in the classical HMM, a single parametric distribution doesn't work. We don't want to have L distributions there. We want that to grow. As you get more and more data, I'll bet you there's going to be more and more features of that emission distributions which arise, so we put in the Dirichlet process there. In fact, it's a hierarchical Dirichlet process as well. So that helps make the point about toolbox even better, I think.
Okay, well, we have one more question, last one.
We actually use quite a bit of Bayesian for hidden Markov model inference, and it's very good, so I recommend everybody to take a look. But one of the major problems is in the prior evolution, because we have to estimate a lot of hyperparameters, and sometimes the number of hyperparameters is more than the parameters itself. But now you're talking about an infinite number of parameters, so we have probably an infinite number of hyperparameters.
No, we don't. No, that's really critical. So the classical Bayesian HMM had a lot of hyperparameters, and that's because it had fixed k states.
Yes.
And the number of hyperparameters scaled as size k.
All
right, and then you had to use BIC or something else like that to choose k. We're not doing any of that. We have a distribution on the number of states, and the number of hyperparameters is constant.
Okay.
And it's small.
So it's shared among
exactly.
All the
There's a sharing by this Chinese restaurant franchise. The hyperparameters are really only at the top level, at the menu level. And there's a small, very small number of those.
So there's a prior evolution according to how you distribute the
That's
number
correct.
Of states.
That's
yes.
correct. It's a That's very number, good. Small number of hyperparameters here.
Okay.
In some sense, almost too small that you can't believe it probably needs to be let go a little bit.
It's very good. I mean,
but it's definitely not. This is not your classical Bayesian HMM, where you had the number of states fixed. We're integrating over the number of states. It's random.
Okay.
That's the sitting pattern in the restaurant. It grows at rate log in, and the posterior, it's just random.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I would like us to thank Professor Jordan once again for his wonderful talk. And now we have the coffee break outside till 9:30. Thank you.
Yeah, those are great questions. It's always fun to get helpful questions afterwards.